Go. A tribute to Odin and Wotan. Yeah. The spirit, the mythical Odin, but the spirit in the northern white man. That's what it means. Not that there were real people, not that there was a real Odin, but the spirit represented by the myth. Well, it's 9:26. This is September, and it is 2016. Don't have too many more days to get it done, boys and girls. So if you're going to get it done in September in 2016, you've only got a few days to do it. Otherwise, it's gone forever. You lost your opportunity. And we're at P.O. Box 401, Warsaw, Indiana, 46581. That's where you send your donations for the radio show. And try to get some other more people to sign up for the show. We need to get this show around. I don't know if you can go up to the resist.com and go to our storage place there for the shows and get all the old shows free. You can record them, send them all over the place to your friends. Because a lot of things that I say on this show are a little hard to find, especially if you're wandering around like a blind man in the right wing. And you're totally blind if you're wandering around in the left wing. So it's Moon's Day here in northern Indiana, and it rained pretty hard last night. Yeah. Well, the shooting gallery is open on Monday. Six people have been shot and injured by a shooter in southwest Houston this morning. The gunman was found dead at the scene, according to the HPD Twitter page. No information was immediately available on the subject. Three victims have been transported to the Southwest Memorial Hospital. One has been taken to Ben Taub General Hospital, and two have been transported to Memorial Hospital Medical Center. The incident was initially reported at 6:30 a.m. near Randall's grocery store at Wesleyan and Bissonnette. The shooter allegedly fired several times into the strip center at that location. Assistant Chief Richard Mann said gunfire lasted about 20 minutes at Law Street near Wesleyan Plaza. That's a long time for a shootout, 20 minutes. Six patients are in the area hospitals, he said. The injuries range from extreme wounds to a few that are more serious, he said. Oh, extremity wounds. There are no fatalities at this time, he said. Well, let's see if there's anything else going on here. Okay. All right, let's see. I'm trying to find out whether there's any identification. No identification of the shooter yet. But what do you want to bet? Well, we know he'll be non-white. But which non-white? Well, a Negro-Canadian diplomat's teenage son has been deported from the United States following his involvement in a fatal drug-related shooting, effectively nullifying the house arrest and probation he had been sentenced to serve, a national news agency reported on Sunday. You think you would get the decision like that yourself? Well, Mark Wabafai Bazu, 15 at the time of the Miami shootings, was deported on September 6, according to the Canadian press. You've got to keep your Canadian niggers up there in Canada. The news agency did not clearly cite its source, but quoted the teen's mother, Roxanne Duby, Canadian Consul General in Miami at the time of the incident, as saying, "It's done, it's done, it's done." Hello.
Hello, this is Lisa with the Green Sunny Survey Company, and you have been selected to
Wait a minute. I forgot to turn off my recorder there, so we're going to have a little dead air, and some stupid bitch called me, and I was stupid enough to answer the phone, some person trying to sell me something, I guess. I've done that before stupidly, and I must chastise myself for it. Anyhow, Wabafai Ababazu, now his name is spelled WabafieBazu. He was in a big shootout down in Miami. He was sentenced this year to nine months of boot camp, followed by 2 years of house arrest and up to 8 years of probation. But once he gets back home in Canada, he's screwed the United States. Under a deal with the prosecution, Wabafai Ababazu pleaded no contest to two counts of third-degree murder. Third-degree murder, it was not just a shootout, it was a murder, aggravated assault and attempted armed robbery, involving the botched March 2015 marijuana deal. So if you want to get out of things or a problem or a crime, you got to be a Canadian nigger, and then you'll walk free, almost free. His mother, according to the foreign ministry, Roxanne Duby, is now director general of its Canadian Foreign Service Institute in Ottawa. See, it pays to be a politician. She's white, husband's black, son is half-breed. Well, the VA's got themselves into hot water, probably for some good reasons. Over the past 2 months, they've been challenged, the VA, over their $20 million high-end art expenditures during a period when 1,000 veterans died without seeing a doctor. Just last month, live on Evening News in San Francisco, a VA spokesman stood in front of the infamous $1.2 million cubed rock sculpture in Palo Alto, California, and argued that this type of artwork creates a healing environment,
Fair's healthcare facility in Palo Alto is one of several pieces of art that has some taxpayer watchdog groups fuming. When thousands of veterans were struggling to receive care, millions of dollars were being spent on art for VA hospitals and clinics across the country. I'm joined now by Adam Angievsky, CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com, a taxpayer watchdog group that unearthed and published much of the VA art spending. Adam, first off, give us some context here. We're talking about $20 million in during a time when veterans were literally dying because they were not getting care.
So our organization at OpenTheBooks.com for the past 2 years has held the VA accountable for its wasteful spending practices. This year, when we updated our numbers, what we found was initially that $5 million of VA checkbook spending on artwork was actually coded as furniture. So we dug deeper into the numbers, and the total figure now exceeds $20 million.
The Bay Area has a few of these pieces of art. Give us a sense of what we're dealing with here. I know we've got the rock in Palo Alto and some items in San Francisco as well.
Well, I think central to our national news story has been the up to $6 million spent at the Palo Alto VA medical facilities on artwork. The VA themselves say that the number is north of $4 million, but I think when you add in all the maintenance costs, the cost of procurement and installation, and actually over six figures spent on additional art consultants for the Palo Alto VA, the number is north of $6 million.
The VA is defending itself, saying that the spending is part of the whole picture here and that veterans deserve facilities that are just aesthetically pleasing as other facilities around the country. Here's what the acting director in Palo Alto told us this afternoon. Take a listen.
Our veterans are our national resource, and they deserve the best possible healing environment that we can provide them. Healing environments and art is involved with that healing environment. We want to be able to provide the best therapies, the best buildings, the best everything for men and women who have served our country.
So, Adam, does he have a point that, you know, we don't want every VA hospital to look like a prison, right?
And we agree with that entire sentiment expressed by the VA spokesman, but the VA needs policy change. On artwork, the veterans should be benefiting from the display of artwork. Nobody tells a veteran's story better than a veteran, and certainly the VA needs a new policy to stop the extravagant expenditure, tens of millions of dollars, on pricey artwork.
So what's the solution?
So if people come to OpenTheBooks.com, they can follow us on social media. We've started a hashtag, VetsArt4VA. The veterans need to show the VA what they're missing. Upload the VA art, upload your art to the hashtag, and let's show Secretary Robert McDonald, the Secretary of the VA, actually what they're missing.
All right. Adam Angievsky, CEO and founder of OpenTheBooks.com. Thank you.
All right, the Obama administration says the VA is back on track after 2 years of scandal. But then we find out they've spent nearly $20 million on, get this, art for the blind. Details next.
Veterans said there are no more wait times, and he touted the progress his administration had made with the VA.
Well, working together over these past 8 years, we've delivered real progress for our veterans. Since I took office, we've made historic increases in veterans funding, the biggest boost in decades. Altogether, during my presidency, we will have increased funding for veterans by more than 85%.
Well, that's true. If there's one thing President Obama has done well at the VA, it's spend money. But where has that money been going? A new report put out by a watchdog group called Open the Books shows that over the last 10 years, amid the wait time scandal, as veterans were dying on secret wait lists, the VA spent nearly $20 million, yes, $20 million on art.
Well, here to explain is the co-founder and CEO of Open the Books, Adam Anshesky. Both his father and grandfather are veterans. Thank you so much for being with us, Adam.
Good morning. Thank you very much for your interest in our work.
Yeah, well, it sounds troubling. Explain how all this money could be going to something like art when veterans were dying while waiting for care.
Well, putting this in perspective, over the course since 2004, our honorary chairman is Dr. Tom Coburn, the former U.S. senator. And when he was in the Senate, he did an oversight report, and he found that up to 1,000 veterans died over a 10-year period while simply waiting to see a doctor. When we looked at the artwork procurement from the VA during this period, we found $20 million spent on artwork. The majority of that, about $18 million, came after 2009. So we found artificial Christmas trees priced like cars and sculptures that cost more oftentimes than five-bedroom homes.
Interesting. So I'm a big fan of what you've done at Open the Books in helping expose a lot of the things the VA does. And a lot of this art, it's coded as furniture. I mean, hidden in the code, in the bureaucracy. Does the VA want us to know this or see this? I mean, is this something they're open about, or are they spending lavishly on these things and hoping we won't recognize it?
Right. A lot of the oversight, it was difficult to find the $20 million figure that we did find. First off, we found $5 million, as you mentioned, hidden as furniture payments. Now, one of the worst examples that we found was at a Palo Alto center that serves blind veterans. We found two sculptures commissioned by that unit for a total of $670,000. Blind veterans can't see fancy sculptures, and I think every veteran, and right now there's a 500,000 veterans still waiting to see a doctor.
Their family and friends would be able to, so I don't know if that's a fair thing, but if the artwork was going to be used at the VA, wouldn't it be helpful if maybe some of the artists were veterans themselves?
Well, we think that the policy change going forward, so U.S. Senator Mark Kirk has called for an immediate moratorium, stop spending money on the pricey artwork. We advocate on our social media at OpenTheBooks.com, we advocate a new policy. It's a common sense policy. Veterans should benefit. Nobody tells the veteran story better than a veteran. We found national museums dedicated to veteran art, and veterans should be the one with their story, with their artwork in the VA medical centers. I just think it's common sense.
Adam, it's a
and
great,
the VA Secretary Robert McDonnell.
It's a great point. There's so much
artwork
and other things that created in vets and the vets community that you could do that. That cube rock sculpture you talked about, it cost $483,000, but another $800,000 to install it. So you're talking about $1.2 million right there for that. Listen, they may appreciate that, but I'd rather have a timely health care appointment. Adam, thank you very much for opening up the books on the VA, and we'll continue to follow your work.
Super. Thanks for your interest in our work.
You got it. Thank you.
Hello? Yes, I'm back on. I had a problem here with my microphone. But there you go. I must say that the VA hospital that I go to here in Indiana does not appear to have any of this lavish art crap in it, like a big boulder in the front yard costing $1.2 million, not only half for the rock and the rest for installing it. So they're not all the VA hospitals are into that kind of lavish spending. Well, back in March 2014, the New York City bomber came back to the U.S. from a year-long trip to a known terrorist hotspot. Customs officials didn't feel his story added up, so they sent his file to the National Targeting Center. In August the same year, he assaulted his brother and stabbed his sister. His father told police, "My son is a terrorist. You need to check him out." You'll be shocked and amazed when you learn what the FBI did with this information.
Hi, this is Brass Check, and we're posting this on Monday, September 26th. And we would have had it up Friday, but the guy that does technical work for me doesn't work on the weekends. So you would have had it on Friday, but even getting it 3 days late, you're still way ahead of anybody that is trying to follow the New York bombing story via the mass media. Our first question when that bomb went off, when we heard the bomb went off, was how long has the FBI known the guy or guys who did it, and how involved were they in it? And that may seem like an extremely cynical question, but stick around and make sure you watch the end of this video, and you'll realize that it's not so cynical at all. But anyway, if you haven't been following this, bombs went off, police closed off the street, didn't do a whole lot more. They didn't really interview witnesses. They didn't put up posters asking if anybody saw anything. They just closed the street, hung out, and waited. And lo and behold, miraculously, in quotes, the perpetrator, or one of them at least, was found. A miracle. Turns out, though, they knew him. They met him for the first time, or the federal government met him for the first time in March, well, they say they met him for the first time in March 2014, and his name is Rahimi, and when he was returning from one of his many trips to terrorist hotspots, this time he was coming back from a nearly year-long trip to a Taliban-controlled part of western Pakistan, he was, the immigration people, the customs people, took him aside for secondary screening. Fair enough. They did their job. And in the secondary screening process, they really didn't like his answers that much. So they referred his case to the National Targeting Center. And this is a federal agency that we pay big bucks to every year to track potential terrorist threats. Speaking of big bucks, how much do you think the U.S. pays, forget the wars, which are costing us trillions with a T, how much do you think the U.S. pays per year to fight the terrorist menace? Just hazard a guess. Well, if you guessed $100 billion with a B, you got it right. We spend $100 billion a year supposedly fighting the terrorist threat. And that works out in 10 years to $1 trillion. That's real cash. And if you take 50 states and divide that number, $100 billion, that gives every state a whole lot of money, about $2 billion. Now, I don't think North Dakota and Idaho need that much money, but let's say they each get $2 billion. There's a thousand millions in billion. So that would be, what they could do instead of what they're doing is offer a $1 million reward to anybody who turns in a potential terrorist. That would provide 2,000 awards per year, per state, for anybody who provides information leading to the capture of a homegrown domestic terrorist. You think they might find a few that way? It's just an idea. But here's what they're doing instead. So Rahimi, he spends his year over in terror land, and he comes back. This is, again, an able-bodied, military-aged man. They do secondary screening, all praise to the customs guys that decided to do that. They didn't like his answers, so they passed it on to the National Targeting Center. They did their job. The customs guys did, at least. A couple of months later, August 2014, Rahimi beats up his sister and stabs his brother. Police come. Dad tells the police, My son's a terrorist. Police did what they were supposed to do, told the FBI. The FBI came in, and what did they do? Here's a guy they knew had been in Terrorland for a year. According to his father, he was a terrorist and acting completely off the wall. He had just beaten up his sister and stabbed his brother. So what did the FBI do? They ran an investigation and gave him a clean bill of health. Does that sound a little strange to you? Imagine if you beat up your brother and stabbed your sister and had spent a year in Terrorland, and your own father said that you were a terrorist and said that you were watching, you know, jihadist videos and listening to jihadist talks and spouting anti-American jihadist craziness. Do you think you would just walk away? And you were in jail, by the way, because you tend to get arrested when you beat up your sister and stab your brother. And you were in jail. Do you think you would just skate away from that? There'd be no problem. And what the FBI said was, well, we didn't talk to him because he was in jail. And we didn't think his attorney would like it. They never talked to him. So they did this great investigation. $100 billion a year are spent on these investigations. They did this amazing investigation, but they never talked to the guy who had this track record of being in Terrorland for a year, of beating up his sister, stabbing his brother, and of being accused of being a terrorist by his dad. They didn't. That wasn't enough. That wasn't enough to go on. I mean, they didn't want to upset the guy's attorney, because the guy's attorney might not have liked it. I mean, have you ever heard of a bigger steaming pile of bullshit in your life? Number one, the FBI has never gone to a prosecutor and said, we've got some extra information on this guy, Mr. Prosecutor. We need you to help us find out what's going on here. We need to put the screws to this guy. The charges couldn't have been that bad. Or the trial outcome couldn't have been that bad, because in 2 years he was out and building bombs and blowing things up, apparently. So he didn't spend much time in jail. Has the FBI never gone to a prosecutor and said, hey, you know, we want you to help us put the screws to this guy and get some information out of him? That's never happened in the entire history of the FBI. A prosecutor has never laid extra charges on somebody to pressure them into doing something that the prosecutor thought needed to be done. Do you mean to tell me that American prosecutors don't take terrorist threats seriously? These are all the things that we're supposed to believe if we believe the FBI narrative. Another thing, you may or may not be aware of this, but it's very common for the FBI to go to Muslim families that have immigration problems or even legal problems, and put pressure on them to become informants or even operatives. If you don't believe me, look it up. Happens every day of the week. But for some reason, in this case, where we've got a young, able-bodied man of military age who spent a year in Terrorland, who came back, who beat up his sister, stabbed his brother, and according to his own father, is a terrorist. That, for some reason, that doesn't seem to necessitate a conversation with the guy. They never talked to him. They never talked to him. The National Targeting Center had him on their record as somebody who had been to Terrorland for a year. You know, Terrorland, you know, these terror places aren't much fun. Like, you don't go there to get a suntan. You don't go there to unwind. You don't go there to brush up on your Arabic. These are miserable, horrible parts of the world. If you're there for a year and you don't have a family reason or a career reason to be there, something's up. And you don't need to be Sherlock Holmes to know that. But apparently the FBI doesn't employ Sherlock Holmes, or they don't employ Sherlock Holmes in this particular case. So we have a major, at a minimum, failure of the FBI to do their job.
Well, I hate to tell this guy, but it's quite obvious to me what was going on. he spent several trips going to Pakistan, Afghanistan, back and forth, back and forth. He was working for the feds. He was a spy for the CIA or some level of U.S. government, the United States Army or something. It's obvious. So, but then he went off the range. He went off the tracks. And so they're embarrassed, but they can't admit he was spying for the U.S. government. That's the answer out there, dummies. It's going to be interesting to see what kind of a sentence he gets if it goes to trial. You wait and see. Watch this case, and you'll probably see what's going on, because if he tries to talk and tell the whole story, he'll end up dead in a jail. We'll see. Well, there's another sect of Islam you got to deal with now. They're basically in New York. I don't know how many other cities. It's called Sufism. A mystical branch of Islam has been cloaked in secrecy for most of its existence, having been forced underground by Ottoman rulers in the 13th century. Nowadays, however, many of these spiritual communities, like the Beloveds in Mr. Latif's apartment, are in plain view around the city if you know where to look. Now, these guys are Americans, probably even Jews, that are converted to this another whacked-out religion. Some can be found through a simple Google search. The Murid Order, for instance, meets in West Harlem and follows the teaching of a Sinhalese founder, Amadou Bamba, which is probably black Sinhalese. The Tinjanyaya group congregates on Fridays in a brownstone in Bedford-Stuyvesant, Brooklyn. The Nashqalabandis meet on Saturday night in a 19th century church on 9th Avenue in Manhattan. Ahmad Khan Ramahamdi, the New Jersey man whom the authorities blame for the September 17th bombing in Manhattan, which prosecutors have said injured 31 people, is believed to have been inspired by radical Islam. American Muslims' condemnations of the attack were immediate. Of course, that happens. But some were accompanied by concern that it could provoke anti-Muslim hysteria. Now, from the looks of the people that are in these meetings, they're mostly white people, at least in some of their groups. Whacked out white people that go from one whacked out religion to another whacked out religion. The Council on American Islamic Relations, or CAIR, a civil liberties organization, issued a statement that said, "Our nation is most secure when we remain united and reject the fear-mongering and guilt by association often utilized following such attacks," unquote. Anna Maria Agosta, who grew up in an Italian-American family in Brooklyn and became a Sufi in 2009 after exploring paganism, Wicca, and Buddhism, seemed to agree with this statement. "I feel a deep responsibility to stand for the true message of Islam, which is peace, tolerance, compassion," Ms. Agosta said. "This is a message of Sufism. As a lesbian advocate for gay rights and a member of the congregation in Tribe K, she led a service to honor those killed in the Orlando, Florida massacre this summer, because most of them were homosexuals." Well, anyhow, that's enough of that. So this is another. You're going to see now all these white people who are always looking for some whacked out religion to gravitate to. They try every Christian church, and then they end up going into some new whacked out cult. And you're going to see more and more of those, and they will be, many of them will be radicalized, and they're going to be a lot of white people. And so get ready for that. Well, I don't think many of you will remember or weren't even born when George Lincoln Rockwell was writing about Chinese Jews, and all the right-wing conservatives poked fun at him, laughed at him about Chinese Jews. Well, I've known for a long, long time that there were Chinese Jews in China for 1,000 years. They had places they meet in their buildings in China from way back. Okay, the rooms were ruddy-faced Chinese and women, once assembled to pray in Hebrew and Mandarin, are silent. Signs and exhibits that celebrate centuries of Jewish life have disappeared. An ancient well, believed to be the last visible remnant of a long-demolished synagogue, was recently buried under concrete and a pile of earth. After locking down Buddhist monasteries in Tibet and tearing down church across eastern China, President Xi Jinping's campaign against unapproved religion and foreign influence has turned to an unlikely adversary, a small group of Jews whose ancestors settled in this now faded imperial city near the banks of the Yellow River more than 1,000 years ago. See? Conservative right-wingers, they're all fucked up and they criticized George Lincoln Rockwell horribly, you know. A few hundred residents had staged a lively, sometimes contentious rebirth of Kaifeng's Jewish heritage in recent decades with classes, services, and proposals to rebuild the lost synagogue as a museum. Some residents even migrated to Israel. For years, the city government tolerated their activities, seeing the Jewish link as a magnet for tourism and investment. But since last year, the authorities have come down hard on the revival in the example of how even the smallest spiritual groups can fall under the pall of the Communist Party's suspicion. No, I think it's a social and civil and racial situation. They want to maintain a religion that corresponds to their culture, which would be Buddhism. The government has shut down organizations that help foster Jewish rediscovery, prohibited residents from gathering to worship for Passover and other holidays, and removed signs and relics of the city's Jewish past from public places. Quote, "The whole policy is very tight now," said Gu Yan, 35, a tour guide who advocates the distinctively Chinese strain of Judaism and runs a small museum in an apartment filled with the pictures of Kaifeng's Jewish past. Quote, "China is sensitive about foreign activities and interferences. Only about 1,000 people claim Jewish ancestry in this city, a drop in China's ocean of 1.35 billion people, or Kaifeng's population of 4.5 million, and only 100 or 200 of them have been active in Jewish religious activities. Nobody outside the government seems to know for sure why this tiny band of believers came to be viewed as a threat. But officials appear to have become alarmed about their growing prominence sometime last year, as Mr. Xing's government demanded that religious groups and foreign organizations bow to tighter controls. Judaism is not one of China's five state-licensed religions: Buddhism, Catholicism, Islam, Protestantism, and Taoism. Well, I'll tell you, part of this goes back to the ancient wars between the Chinese and the Mongols. And that's, of course, why they built the Chinese Wall, was to keep the Mongols out. And it did a good job for a long time. But finally, the Mongols went through it, or around it, over it, or whatever, and took over China. But since the Mongols were not very good at running governments, they imported Jews to do all this paperwork of the government. And they put them in all kinds of places around in the government. But as time went on, Chinese leaders became more suspicious of the Jews and run them out. So they, a lot of people in China remember this through history books and so forth. So that's one of the reasons they're not that keen on Judaism in China. Well, I see Donald Trump has decided he released a list of 33 prominent conservative Catholic advisors for his campaign. According to reports from Philly.com, the announcement comes in the midst of a highly contentious election season and at a time when Trump is struggling in the polls among Catholic voters, according to some reports. Among the released names of advisors are former Republican Senator Rick Santorum, who ran for the presidency in 2012 and 16. When he left the race in February, Santorum originally endorsed Senator Marco Rubio, another Catholic. When Rubio left the race in March, Santorum endorsed Trump, citing the vacant Supreme Court seat is the key reason. Another key person reported as a new Catholic advisor for Trump is Joseph Sella, founder of the National Catholic Prayer Breakfast, who reportedly will be the chief liaison to Trump campaign for Catholic affairs. Notably, Sella is a signatory of the An Appeal to Our Fellow Catholics, an open letter written by George Weigel and Robert George in March during the primaries, and signed by more than 30 Catholic intellectual readers, including Robert George, law professor at Princeton University, Mary Rice Hassan, director of the Catholic Women's Forum at Ethics, and the Public Policy Center, and Thomas Farr, director of the Religious Freedom Project at Georgetown University. The letter denounced Trump as a man manifest unfit to be president, who has driven our politics down to new levels of vulgarity, citing Trump's ethnic prejudices, promises to punish families of terrorists, and his sudden about-face on pro-life issues, among other issues. The signatories pleaded with Catholics not to vote for Trump. Goes on to give a whole bunch of names that other people he's going to use, so it's going to be interesting to see whether he's going to buy off the Catholics. As you know, the two people running for president, Mrs. Clinton and Ronald McDonald, met with Netanyahu yesterday in New York City, evidently to get their orders. I imagine they met at different times, but that just shows you how, you know, last time there was an election, Netanyahu was very active on behalf of, I forget who it was at the time, their names escape me, but it just shows the power of the Jews from Israel on our elections. The Trump campaign press release following the meeting on Sunday between Benjamin Netanyahu and the GOP presidential candidate stated that Trump told Netanyahu, quote, a Trump administration would finally accept the longstanding congressional mandate to recognize Jerusalem as the undivided capital of the state of Israel, unquote. Now, us meddling in these affairs is ridiculous. We should have nothing to do with that. They can fight that out over there. But for U.S. presidents to get involved in that kind of thing is ridiculous. The statement also said Trump agreed that the military assistance provided to Israel and the missile defense cooperation with Israel are an excellent investment for America. Yeah, it puts it farther and farther in debt. And there will be extraordinary strategic, technological, military, and intelligence cooperation between the two countries, should Trump be elected. Interesting. Trump emphasized that Israel is a vital partner of the United States in the global war against radical Islamic terrorism. According to the statement, the nuclear deal with Iran and ways to defeat ISIS were also discussed, as well as Israel's successful experience with a security fence that helped secure its borders. A short while before Sunday's meeting between Benjamin Netanyahu and Donald Trump, the GOP presidential candidate, and the tweeter, he tweeted, long forward to my meeting with Benjamin Netanyahu in the Trump Tower at 10 a.m. The meeting lasted an hour and 20 minutes behind closed doors, and the two did not speak to the press before or after. The Prime Minister's office released a laconic statement saying Netanyahu presented to Trump Israel's positions on regional issues related to its security and discussed with him Israel's efforts to achieve peace and stability in our region. The PM's office also said that Netanyahu thanked Trump for his friendship and support for Israel. The meeting included Israel ambassador to the U.S. Ron Dermer and Trump's son-in-law, Jewish businessman, investor, and political operative Jared Kushner. I just wonder what all these right-wingers are saying that, like Duke, that opposing Trump is being anti-Aryan or anti-white. And all these right-wingers that ran off to follow Trump. Netanyahu was scheduled to meet next with Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton, who has already committed to inviting the Israeli PM to her White House as soon as she's sworn in. Clinton is on the record as supporting the nuclear deal with Iran, but repeats her commitment to Israel's security. In an interview with Israel's Channel 2 TV, Clinton said, Trump should worry every Israeli. Oh. Regardless of his positions on Israel. The two meetings were arranged when a senior Netanyahu official told reporters after his meeting with President Obama that he hadn't been approached by either candidate for a meeting while he's in the U.S., but should they invite him, he'd be delighted to accept. A day later, the invite came from Trump's campaign, followed by one from Hillary. Well, there you go, boys and girls. He's a good National Socialist. Oh, man. You know, the right wing, left wing and the right wing, I laugh my ass off at how gullible they are. And people like Duke grab onto these kind of things just to get a little more yardage and a little bigger mailing list. And but now he's going to have to live with it. Of course, he'll come up with some screwy excuse. Well, maybe I was wrong a little bit, but you know how it goes. Well, a huge majority of Europe's Jews say they're staying home for the holidays. Around 70% of Europe's Jews say they're afraid to go to synagogue for Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. Participants in the call were briefed on the recent terrorist attacks that have taken place in the United States, including the New York, New Jersey bombings that left 29 people injured in Manhattan's Chelsea neighborhood. The officials reviewed security procedures, including pointers on how to deal with active shooters. Well, you run, that's what you do. Run, kike, run. It'd be sort of amusing to watch all these Orthodox Jews in their black outfits with a Colt 45 strapped to their belts walking around New York City.
Hi, this is Brass Check. Normally, we like to run other people's videos because there's a lot of ground to cover and there's not many of us here at Brass Check. But sometimes important topics just don't get covered, so we have to step up and cover them ourselves. The topic today is self-driving cars, questions nobody is asking. Question number one, where is the consumer demand for self-driving cars? Have you ever wanted one? If you've ever wanted one, and I seriously doubt that you ever have, how high is it up the tree of your order of priorities? My guess is it's pretty low. And yet, self-driving cars, Tesla, Google, they're all in it. It's the biggest thing ever. People like Mark Andreessen, the inventor of the browser and the venture capitalist, oh, we got to have self-driving cars. We need them now. Why? The answer that they give is self-driving cars will be safer. And that there's all these accidents going on. If we only had self-driving cars, we wouldn't have accidents. I'm sorry. That seems insane to me. How many times can you not get your PC to work or your laptop to work or an internet connection to work or a website to work? Software failure is the norm. Downtime on a server, if it's less than 1%, is considered a miracle. Well, if you're out there in busy traffic, 1% downtime is enough to kill you. So I don't get that software is going to make us safer. I think that's a completely bogus argument. Let's look at some other things. You can Google this in the news, but apparently it's just been announced that, one of the little features of the self-driving car is that it will pull itself over when the police want you to be pulled over. Well, that's handy. Don't most people already pull over anyway? And the small number of people who don't pull over are criminals. Why are we putting in a feature, a quote feature, in the self-driving car that disables the car, in essence? All software programs have backdoors, and these days, thanks to the NSA, secret backdoors are written to all software. Do you really think that a hacker won't be able to figure out how to hack into these backdoors and take control over your car? Now, interestingly enough, you know, everybody talks about the self-driving car and the autonomous car. What they're really saying is this is a car that consumers won't be able to control. If it works, and I doubt that it will work the way they think, you'll get in, I guess you'll tell the car where you want it to go, and it will take over. Isn't that lovely? But it taking over means you don't have control. Something else does. This something is software. Well, somebody writes software, somebody controls some software, somebody manipulates software. So basically you're handing the control of your vehicle over to another person. That's fine if it's a taxi driver or a limo driver and you can see the guy and you can exert some level of control over the guy. It's not fine if it's software, because the software is being controlled by somebody, and that somebody is not you. So that's another reason this makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Let's add another reason to the pile. How do you think this self-driving car works? They talk about the cameras and the sensors and the this and the that. They very rarely mention the word radar. If you read the specs on all of these systems, they all use radar. Now, let me ask you a question. How many hours a day do you spend in your car? How many hours a day do your kids spend in your car? How often do you pack a picnic and go sit underneath a radar transmitter for several hours because you like the view? Hopefully you don't do that, and there's a good biological reason why you don't do that. It's not safe. It's not healthy. So these self-driving cars, in addition to taking control away from you and giving it to some unnamed set of forces, also will put you your head, your brain cells, directly under a radar transmitter for as long as you're in a car a day. Let's say that's an hour a day. You know, you have a commute, you do some errands. But, you know, for some people it's a lot longer. But let's just say an hour a day. Do you really want to sit underneath a radar transmitter for an hour a day, every day for the rest of your life? And do you really think it's good for your kids? Do you have infants at home? Do you have grandchildren? Do you have nieces and nephews? Do you really want to put a radar transmitter within arm's length of their developing brains? My guess is you probably do not. Now let's talk about another small element, which is the way these cars work is you're supposed to sit there at the driver's seat paying full attention at all times. Now, the car's going to drive for you, but if a problem comes up, well, you get to instantly intervene and save the day. Really? Really? When you have your hand, this is the most, this is so beyond insane. It's hard to even articulate, but let's articulate it. When you're driving a car, you need your attention on the wheel and on your car and what's in front of your car and the cars around you at all times, like without pause for even 1 second. Cars are dangerous. Cars do kill people. Cars really don't kill people. Drivers kill people. But cars are able to inflict incredible harm to people. So when you're operating one, you shouldn't be drunk. You shouldn't be texting. You shouldn't be watching TV. Remember when, I don't know if you guys remember, but there was a brief time when people were putting television screens on their driver's wheels. Look it up. Google it. It was a reality. I don't know if it's still being done, but that was the rage for a while. All these things are insane. All these things lead to increasing the chances of an accident exponentially. So the idea of telling a driver, hey, just chill out, read a book, you know, Google, Facebook, you know, get on your smartphone, you know, do whatever. But on a second's notice, we may hand the driving wheel back to you. And, of course, you'll be ready, right? Because you've been looking at kitten videos. So self-driving cars are a complete scam. I'm assuming at a minimum it's a make-work project for the tech industry, but it's also a way to take away your freedom, to take away your control over your own life. So why no one has ever done a video on this, I don't know. But BrassCheck felt we had to stand up today and do it. Please share this video. We don't have money to buy advertising. We're not plugged into the social media whirlwind. We're not going to appear on CNN. We're not going to even appear on Democracy Now! Or any of those channels. We're just common sense people astonished at what goes on in this world and is not talked about. So self-driving cars, are they a good idea? You tell me.
Can't you just see niggers in a automatic drive car? Drunk or drugged up niggers in one of these automatic cars. That's something I would like to see. Well, we got a situation right here in Fort Wayne, Indiana, which is only 50 miles away, and I go up there every once in a while. They're trying to let the Negroes know that how much they love them, especially black male Negroes. Fort Wayne, incidentally, has, I'm not sure exactly how many, but probably 3 or 4 murders by blacks a month or more. But Fort Wayne United is a mayoral initiative, the mayor, you know. He combines two national efforts, Cities United and My Brother's Keeper, into one organization. The vision for the organization, Headley explained to a group of men on Saturday, was to make sure that every black male in Fort Wayne feels respected and valued with the opportunity to reach his full potential. Have you ever heard of a program to make sure every white male in Fort Wayne feels respected and valued with the opportunity to reach his full potential? I doubt it. Indiana Law School Professor Andre Douglas Pond Cummings, co-chair of the steering committee for the Fort Wayne United, contributed to the conversation. Participants also completed surveys to further help Fort Wayne Police Department. After a year and a half of moderating these sessions, Headley said black men are misunderstood, especially when they rape and pillage. Quote, we are stereotyped. There's a lot of implicit biases about black males, so we get the opportunity to challenge that. We get the opportunity to combat that with these types of sessions. We get to learn what they think and really just fight against biases in a positive way, said Headley, who is black. The question on the overhead screen read, have you ever felt racially profiled by the police? Out of the group, 65% said, yes. One participant expanded on his choice, recalling how an officer had asked him, quote, how did you get this car? What do you do for a living? Probably black guy, probably driving a Rolls Royce. During a stop regarding the speed limit, another participant said he couldn't understand why two additional police cars were necessary when he's pulled over after leaving a friend's house one night. Well, it's because the cops are afraid of these crazy blacks. The new young cops are afraid of them. And they got a good reason why. You never know when one of these new bangies are going to come up with a gun and start firing at you. Both Westfield and Reed explained how they had encouraged officers to back each other up when possible. Reed explained how Westfield manages the greatest amount of patrol officers in the Southeast Quadrant. He said it's the city's busiest quadrant. Does he mean crime-wise? And Headley presented a chart showing that the highest number of police calls come from that area, and it's mostly black. Because of recent spikes in shootings, Reed said that there has been an increased police presence in the three sectors of the southeast area. It may not send a positive message to the neighbors, but Reed and the Westfield believe that the presence may have stopped at least two shootings in the last night. What's funny to me is these people, they want the police to protect them, but when the police stop anybody and there's any argument, they hate the cops. They hate the cops, but they love the cops. It's amazing. And that's in this town not that far from me. They're just as... It's mostly a white town. They're just nuts. They're just as nuts as the niggers as far as I'm concerned. Well, that's it for Moon's Day, boys and girls. I hope that's exciting enough for you, but if not, I'll try to do better tomorrow. Remember, 14-5, I have nothing to say.
Any Latinos here? I didn't talk about the Mexicans. Let me blue. Good. Good. Let's get this Mexican shit straight. L.A. is Mexico. Don't let the white folks fool you. That's Mexico. If you don't believe it, take your Mexican parents to the border. They run right back to Los Angeles. Didn't the Mexicans have, in L.A., they had some, what's your holiday, Cinco, some shit, what is it? Cinco de Mayo. Oh, you scared white folks. Oh, thousands of white Mexicans came to downtown L.A., thousands of them. Got out the same car, scared the fuck out of white folks. And I like Mexicans in L.A., I don't know about here, but Mexicans, I like you guys. You guys are independent. You'll sell pencils, oranges on the side of the freeway. You don't give a fuck. Mexican won't ask you for directions. They ain't asking nobody for shit. Niggas used to be like that before they got integrated, got like white folks and went crazy. Because we done been all kind of things. We've been colored, Negro, black, African, been all that shit. It's true. You guys got to be all kind of names. Isn't that a bitch? How come we just can't be free? That's what I want. Totally. I'm going to see that shit. I'm taking every motherfucker with me. We ain't gonna be free. We gonna be dead together. How about that? No justice, no peace. I said, fuck that. We don't get peace till we get even. Fuck that bullshit. I'm a get even motherfucker. And then we'll get some peace after I do some shit.